And you are listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, there have been several developments connected to the coronavirus in Siouxland this week. Local health officials Tuesday announced Woodbury County's first death from the coronavirus. At the time, did not identify the individual. However, his wife told the Sioux City Journal 64-year-old Raimundo Corral, a frontline worker at Tyson Fresh Meats Dakota City beef plant died Saturday afternoon in his Sioux City home. His wife, Annabelle, told the Journal on Tuesday she believes the company didn't react quickly enough to an outbreak of the coronavirus. As of last Friday, 23 workers at the Dakota City plant had tested positive for COVID-19. Tyson has issued a statement about the death, saying the company was deeply saddened by the loss of a team member from our Dakota City plant and are keeping the family, as we've heard, in our thoughts and prayers. And the Sioux City Police Department says 9 of its staff members have tested positive for COVID-19. The staff members include the police chief, a captain, 2 lieutenants, a sergeant, an officer, and 3 civilian staff members. All of these employees work near each other in 2 offices of the police headquarters. These staff members were not working with the public to respond to complaints or make arrests. And one of the state's largest health systems, with a healthcare facility in Sioux City, has announced it will be cutting some of its staff's hours and pay in response to the COVID-19 outbreak. Unity Point Health, which is headquarters in West Des Moines, announced this week it would be furloughing or reducing hours for staff in departments that are closed or not operating at capacity. It also reduced its executive pay by 15%. The nonprofit health system says it has experienced, quote, unprecedented challenges and volume declines as a result of the global pandemic. Governor Kim Reynolds has suspended all non-essential medical procedures through the end of the month. And state officials announced a public-private effort to expand coronavirus testing this week. Governor Kim Reynolds is encouraging Iowans to visit testiowa.com to take an assessment. Reynolds says it will notify people if they qualify for a COVID-19 test and will schedule them for a test at a drive-through location. And since Governor Reynolds announced that schools would not be back in session this semester, the Sioux City Community School District has been making plans for this year's graduating class and next year's students as well. I talked with Superintendent Paul Gosman about how a virtual graduation ceremony might work.
First of all, we acknowledge the class of 2020 has had a year like no other class. We recognize that one of the greatest things that a student can do or a parent can do related to that child's education is to walk across that commencement stage. Frankly, it's one of the greatest things a teacher gets to do, as well as to watch those students walk across that stage. And so, obviously, the governor of Iowa has made the declaration that schools will remain closed through the end of the school year. And our graduation or commencement exercises were scheduled before the end of that year. And so they have not lifted any of those restrictions related to COVID-19 that would allow us to put more than 10 people in a room. So the traditional commencement exercises just cannot occur at their traditional time. And so we decided to make on the calendar for a virtual commencement exercise. And we've partnered with a company that's going to help us put that on for our students. The things that are included in a virtual commencement are much like you would find in a traditional commencement, where there will be some music. You will hear from the proper dignitaries like the school principal and the school board president. The superintendent will probably even say a few words. You will hear from the speakers of the top percentage of the class of 2020. And then we will move to a section of that program, that virtual program, where we'll effectively virtually confer a diploma to each student by showing their picture and a little bit about them. We've got about 350 students in each of our high school graduating classes. So North and East have both about 350, and then our West High is a little less than that, closer to 300 students, just because they happen to be a slightly smaller high school. And that will be scheduled to be presented at a specific time on the net so that students can log in and watch that. But of course, they can retain it then for later as well. Also, as a part of that, we've created a yard sign for each of our seniors that they can place at their property to signify that the district is very proud that a graduate of 2020 lives there at that particular location. And so that's what we're doing with the virtual piece of this. But we haven't, Mary, closed the door on the possibility that we might get everybody together for an in-person ceremony later. Right now, we've reserved a couple of dates, one in June and one in July, where we would hold our traditional commencement exercises if they're permitted.
You know, looking ahead to the summer and into the fall, I think a lot of people just sort of expect, well, kids will be back in the classroom in the fall, you know, barring anything happening. Are you thinking about, well, how are we going to help these kids catch up, that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely we are. This is like something that we've never experienced before, and the repercussions are going to be like those we've never experienced before. You know, of course, we think about those seniors, and we just talked about them who will be graduating from our district. But if you think about it, a child who's in first grade really uses that second semester of that first grade year to really put a lot of the components of reading together so that when they move into second grade, they can read to learn, not just learn to read. And so we know that they'll come in with some struggle from what we're used to seeing in a normal year, same thing for second graders, for fourth graders, for sixth graders, those sorts of things. And so we do know that the governor has at this point indicated that we will have the opportunity to waive the original start date of school. I'm not announcing that we're going to do that. I don't think that we will. Our start date has been set, and people count on our calendars. But I do think because we can waive a portion of that, I think we will make some more learning opportunities available for groups of students who may need a little extra work to kind of engage in a education boot camp of sorts to get ready for that school year to begin at the normal time and hopefully hit the ground running as a part of that process.
You know, I was thinking about kids that are leaving elementary school, going to middle school, kids that are leaving middle school, going to high school. I imagine, you know, it's sort of much the same as you were saying. They can, and to try to sort of get in the swing with a whole new world.
Well, that's right. You know, right now we have a process in place that we're referring to as voluntary continuous learning. That's something the state permitted us to do. And so we're making packets of information available for elementary kids and digital information available for middle school and high school kids every week. And that's been great. And not every child is taking part, although we hope more and more will as time goes on. But we have been pleasantly surprised with the number who are participating in that in the series of activities. And so we're hopeful that that'll push away some of that academic slide that would occur from schools simply being closed.
I'm certainly happy that like my daughter has been able to meet up with her fifth grade class from Bryant, and they've done, you know, the Zoom, and so many kids join in, and they're just, I think it's really nice just for them to have that experience, and they seem so happy to see each other.
Yeah, it is really interesting to watch, because, you know, you would have thought, you know, 4 months ago that our ability to do online instruction and class meetings and those sorts of things was frankly impossible. But this challenge has caused us to discover what is possible. And so we're doing things in ways we've never done them before. And frankly, I think it's going to make us all better in the long run. Of course, none of us want to go through the challenges of COVID-19 and the economic burdens that we're about to face are so significant, but there will be some things that are positive that come out of this with respect to some virtual education and distance learning and us finding new and creative ways to serve children.
That was Sioux City School Superintendent Paul Gosman talking about plans for an online graduation ceremony for seniors at each of the district's three high schools. He also looked ahead to what needs to be done to get students back into the classroom in the fall. And he announced also, he says there's some Wi-Fi hotspots for students to use to take part in continuous learning while school is out. This week, the big headline, small business assistance gobbled up by major corporations, a move making an impact in Sioux City. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer has a sampling of a few of the local establishments, some in okay shape, others facing an uncertain future.
The COVID-19 pandemic greatly altered the financial stability of small businesses all across the country, including here in Siouxland. Some are forced to temporarily close their doors, like a barbershop owned by Clyde Chenal.
I'm just like stuck in my house waiting to go back to work, hoping they just let us up on the first so, you know, I could have some relief.
Chenal says he tried to find that relief. but was told he wasn't eligible for help from the state or federal government. He's now waiting for unemployment to kick in.
I mean, everybody's going through it, so, you know, I can't just complain, but I guess I got it better than some and worse than others.
Others can still operate, but in a different way. Eric Martin owns and operates Marto Brewing Company on 4th Street in Sioux City.
It's definitely a major impact on us. You know, shut down our tap room, so we can no longer have inside sales, so nobody come in and have food and drinks and hang out here and enjoy the environment. So we had to move to a to-go only food menu, and beer out of the tap room was sold to-go, and our 25-ounce cans. We've also shifted our plan a little bit to increase outside beer sales, so we're selling beer to other retail outlets we never did before. We're also looking to expand some outside distribution around the state of Iowa. In terms of revenue loss, we definitely seen almost half of our revenue loss because of the impact of this situation, but we're doing all we can to increase that number.
And obviously for you, there's an extra challenge because you're a fairly new operation. You just launched last year.
The first year of business is always the toughest, or so many people say. And, you know, we have unexpected expenses that happen during the build-out phase. You know, we started seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. Now all of a sudden this happens, and you just have to adjust, do what you can to survive. And we have a good team here. We're in a good position. We'll be fine. We'll make it through everything.
Were you able to get assistance from the state of Iowa or the federal government at all?
Apply for both of those programs, the state of Iowa grant. That was for businesses of 2 to 25 employees, you know, with a grant up to $25,000. We applied for that. We did not receive a grant for that for anything at all. One possibility is we do have more than 25 employees, but we have a large portion of our employees that are part-time, so just kind of frustrating on that end. We had pretty clear loss of revenue just in that first 2 weeks to show that we could have used some assistance. But we also did apply for the PPP loan. We were fortunate to receive that, and that'll help us out the next couple months here.
So there were some small business owners here in Sioux City who didn't get that assistance from the SBA. They didn't receive their loans, and they're not really sure why. I mean, the money ran out, obviously. I don't know if you're hearing that as well with some of the other small business owners that you run into.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple others. One, for example, they did not receive the loan, but it sounds like that was a banking problem. There was a large national bank. From my understanding, the larger banks kind of missed the boat on this, to where we're fortunate to have a local regional bank that was able to jump on it. And we were fortunate to get processed fairly quickly before the money ran out.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Senate approved more than $300 billion for the Small Business Loan Program that ran out of money last week. The House is expected to pass the measure, and President Trump says he plans to sign it. We talked to another local business owner who wasn't able to secure that original funding for her small company.
My name's Ashley Prince, and our business is Pickled Palette. We were founded in 2014. I started the business. It's eventually grown, and we've added a lot of different things to our studio. So where we kind of started off with doing painting classes, we've then added in pottery, which is a big part of our current business now. Well, because the classes are a large part of our studio business model, we've had to cancel those. So that has impacted us greatly. A good portion of our attendees were very kind, and they understood the situation. And they understand that's a large part of what we do. So we've definitely had to be innovative and change our ways so that we can stay in business until, you know, we have any sense of funding or relief maybe coming our way.
And what are some of those efforts that you're doing to modify?
So we're offering pottery to go and canvas to go. So if you're cooped up in your house and, you know, maybe you are just bored out of your mind or the kids are driving you crazy, we have those kits available and our guests are picking them up curbside. We're taking orders over the phone. That includes brushes and paints. And then our guests are able to pick those up from the studio, create them at home, and then they're dropping them back off for us to fire.
So you've done some modifications to your business, but you also reached out for other assistance as well. Can you tell us how that process turned out for you?
Definitely seen an impact on the pandemic as far as revenue, so we've applied for assistance. We have not yet applied for the EIDL, not quite sure if that's the right fit for us just yet, but definitely the PPP program, we have applied for that.
We have yet to receive funding. Unfortunately, we applied through our bank, and it was kind of a jumbled up process, but we've been told that we're in queue. So if funds are possibly added to that, then hopefully we'll be in line for receiving those.
We're hearing a lot about some larger businesses getting a large portion of that federal money. What are your thoughts about that when you hear that some of the other bigger businesses received money, but then small businesses, local small businesses, aren't necessarily getting that help?
Well, I did, when first reading the process for PPP and the qualifications, it did strike me as unusual. You think of 500 employees or less as a small business. I don't think 500, you know, I think maybe 100 or less. Or in a lot of cases, our mom and pop shops are going to be 10, 15 or less. So I really was confused by when they made that eligibility that large of a number for employee base. It's disheartening. You know, obviously, I think some businesses need maybe a moral check. And we see that kind of coming across in media more and more, you know, several of those large franchises or corporations that, you know, on a regular basis would have the access to that capital by other means where, you know, small mom and pops wouldn't and don't. They're almost being shamed into refunding that money.
The EIDL that Ashley Prince mentioned is the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. We wish Ashley Prince, Eric Martin, and Clyde Chenal all the best as they try to navigate through a very difficult economic time. Chenal says he's been able to spend more time with family, and he seems to be taking everything in stride.
Yeah, I'm like everybody else, I guess, but I guess I'm not like in a food line yet.
Sheila Brummer, Siouxland Public Media News.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. COVID-19 is disrupting agriculture on many levels. The Trump administration recently announced it will spend $19 billion to help farmers, but farmers will need support from the state of Iowa as well. John Lawrence is the vice president of Iowa State University's Extension and Outreach Programs. The Extension Service and its programs are reaching out to food producers to help them reach customers and keep food safe. Lawrence says farmers have had a few rough years with tariff wars and low commodity prices, and COVID-19 is just one more layer of stress.
On top of commodity prices and trade issues, of course, is a terrible weather year, which added to the stress. And then coming into this year, just as we start to get optimistic about planting season and new calves being born and so on, then we have the impact of the pandemic that has really dropped commodity prices. Cattle and hog prices are down about 30% from the time went before we started into the pandemic. Corn and soybean prices are down double digits. Ethanol prices have dropped dramatically. So it has added a lot of financial stress.
Do you get questions about food safety with all the issues of COVID-19 in the packing plants?
We do, but we put out various releases on this that, you know, whether it's the CDC, the World Health Organization, all of the universities that looked at this can find no evidence that the COVID-19 moves on the food itself. And so there's not a concern about passing it through food. It's a human-to-human and respiratory disease.
Are farmers able to take advantage of, say, online sales? You know, they sell sometimes some of their food at farmers markets, open markets here and there. Is there any way that they could do some of that online?
I think part of that is a legal question. I mean, there are obviously some that are trying to do that. Some of the farmers market provisions, and I don't know the details. I just read something about it, and they're looking, I believe, to have an exemption during this pandemic. But the farmers market rules that apply there were for face-to-face sales. And so our team at Extension and Outreach is looking at, are there ways that they can do online sales? And maybe it's pre-orders that are dropped off curbside. Maybe it's our CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, where consumers buy essentially a share in a garden, and those are oftentimes delivered door to door. So people are trying to find creative ways of doing that, to getting fresh produce to the consumers.
I know the Extension Service, I've talked to a couple of agents in the last few weeks. They're in contact with farmers, but they're doing a lot over the phone, over Skype. They said, you know, we've found ways that we can connect with people even if we can't always be there in person.
Well, certainly on the farmer side, this time of the year, we were pretty much done with meetings, right? As farmers went to the field, we were no longer having face-to-face meetings. It was the phone calls, the farm visits, text messages, social media. And so that has continued. And even now, if farmers need somebody to come out and take a look at a field or at a crop, our folks, our specialists can still do that. Now, they can't get in the cab of the pickup and ride with them. They can't ride around in the tractor with them. But if a farmer can mark a spot in the field, a specialist can go take a look at that and then call them on the phone, because we need to keep that physical distance and make sure everybody stays safe. We can still help answer those questions.
How do you look forward, say, to 6 months out, a year out from all this? I think that must be kind of difficult, but you must need to be able to do that to some extent, right?
Well, yeah, we're just now a month, maybe, you know, 4.5 weeks into working remotely and things being closed down and canceled. And so we've been busy shifting things, which were face-to-face meeting, to online and finding new ways to engage our stakeholders. I'm standing up a committee from across our system to begin looking at what recovery may look like. We don't know when that will happen or exactly how it will happen, but we need to be prepared to help Iowans as they begin to recover from COVID, whether that is families who've had, you know, loss of income through this, whether it's youth who now won't have any in face-to-face school for essentially half the spring semester, and how we help them gear up to, you know, go into school in the fall if there's a part there. Certainly our communities, our community economic development team is looking at not only how businesses, individual businesses, may think about recovery, but entire Main Streets and communities as they think about what recovery looks like and what the future may hold, as well as agriculture. And so we'll have a team looking at that, you know, what those needs are, and those that are in our wheelhouse, then we'll gear up to say, how can we help statewide with those efforts? Extension and outreach is more than agriculture, right? Our 4-H youth program, you know, quickly moved things online. We called it 4-H at home, where there are lots of activities for kids, whether they were 4-H club members or not, as they were home, to stay engaged in STEM activities and other learning opportunities. Our human sciences moved a lot of courses online. Things around, we've got one called Question, let's see if I can get the title right here. It's around suicide prevention. Question, persuade, and refer. And it's really targeted at our agribusiness professionals that work with farmers and see them not face-to-face today or across, they're a little further away, but as farmers are dealing with this stress, the lenders, the seed salesmen, the co-op folks, how can they help those farmers that are feeling that stress and maybe head off suicide, which is a concern, a growing concern in the ag community? Our human sciences also have an educational program around relationships and couples, which is, can be challenging enough, but under these stressful situations and maybe where there's a little too much together time now that people are working remotely. Are there tips that can help couples and relationships stay strong through this stressful time? And then our family finance specialists are instead of shifting a bunch of this curriculum online immediately, they simply went to one-on-one education. If there's individuals that are concerned about their family budget, maybe they've lost their job or they've gone on unemployment, and And, you know, how do they reprioritize their budget? And how do they plan for the future in this situation? And our specialists are there to talk them through that, and provide them tips, and direct them to other resources that may help them.
That was John Lawrence, the Vice President of Iowa State University's Extension and Outreach Programs, talking about helping farmers and others in Iowa who are suffering physical, agricultural, and mental distress caused by the changes associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. Specialty hog farmer Chris Peterson lives in Clear Lake, and Peterson was sick with some kinds of virus for weeks, as was his wife, but neither were able to get tested for COVID-19. Peterson says he and his wife were heavily affected by recent tariff wars and low commodity prices over the last few years, but he says he has received no help from the recent stimulus package because a small business like his that showed no income last year was automatically disqualified.
To me, that's a bunch of BS, okay? You know, that's right underneath the IRS tax filing stuff, you know. So that needs to be corrected. I have bills to pay on the farming end, like feed bills and veterinary bills, and then on the living side, you know, we have the normal bills anybody else does. You know, electricity, groceries, car payment if you have newer car. If they don't do something about this, you know, people, it's already going on, believe me, you know, people without work and whatever, they're not going to be able to pay their bills.
And I know a lot of people who've been sick, who were sick a long time, kind of like you were, who've never been able to get a test, right? They're just like you. It's like, I'd really like to know if I had it.
You know, testing is key. I don't, you know, testing is key to, you know, the social distancing, opening up, back up the economy. It's going to be a can of worms. You know, the Spanish flu 100 years ago, there's three waves of it. The second wave, by the way, was the worst. It started 4 months after the first wave. You know, are we in for that? You know, we were absolutely prepared for something like this. And we don't go to town. You know, I went town 10 days ago to top off the gas tank just in case in the car, but that's it. You know, and I do consulting work out of the house, and, you know, I travel a lot, but I, you know, that's all been shut down for 2 months now, the flying and the traveling. I was in Savannah, Georgia, end of January. That's the last big trip I took. And I come back to Atlanta the day they found two cases in Atlanta. And then a week later, I'm very apprehensive about it, but it was a promise. You know, I don't like to break a promise. I was in Rochester, Minnesota, and spoke to a group about sustainable ag and factory farms and stuff like that. And a few days later, you know, it started to pop up in Rochester, and I told the wife and I told the group I consult for, I said, that's it. I'm not, you know, traveling anymore until this blows over. You know, I'm just not. It's not worth dying over.
That was Clear Lake farmer Chris Peterson talking about his struggles to keep his business together in the volatile financial environment caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Well, COVID-19 is affecting all levels of society, including immigrants. Even though President Trump has announced his intention to stop all immigration for the foreseeable future. However, because of fears about being detected by immigration officials, some immigrants may not be tested or treated for the coronavirus. Since 2017, the Trump administration began enforcing rules to hold undocumented immigrants in detention centers, and now there's concern that those centers could be breeding grounds for the spread of COVID-19. Kelsey Freeman learned a lot about immigration and Mexico in 2016 while on a Fulbright scholarship to study immigration and teach English in central Mexico. Freeman details her experiences in her book, No Option But North, The Migrant World and the Perilous Path Across the Border. Freeman says cartel violence is forcing immigrants from Mexico and Central America to flee northward.
Cartel violence has gone from being this fringe operation to really touching and eroding the lives of everyday citizens that don't want to be involved in it. So I talked to several migrants that had been business owners in their whole home country. And business owners typically have to pay a rent to the gang or the cartel that operates in that area. That's pretty standard for areas where gangs are really entrenched.
And so what happened if they couldn't pay?
You either have to do favors for the gang or they threaten your life or you flee. And so I talked to many people in that situation. So really, really gang violence has driven a lot of people north, especially in the Northern Triangle. That is Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and then in parts of Mexico as well.
So we're talking about drug smugglers, right?
Yes. Yeah. So their main operation is drug smuggling, typically, at least for cartels in Mexico. And when I'm talking about gangs in the Northern Triangle, they, you know, can be involved in drug smuggling. So gang violence has become really entrenched and really, really life threatening for thousands of everyday people.
We see a lot of agricultural workers come up through Mexico to the United States, a lot of them in the Midwest. But you say that's really not the best option for a lot of immigrants.
Yeah, so to come as a farm worker through our legal system is really difficult because most employers here in the U.S., agricultural employers, don't use what's called an H-2A visa, which is a visa available to farm workers, because it's really expensive. And it's really cumbersome to use. So you have to go through the process of proving that no U.S. citizen wants that job. You have to pay for consulate fees, pay for the travel for the migrant immigrant to come to the U.S. You have to pay for their housing, pay higher wages on top of that. So, you know, some of those protections are good. But they often make it so that employers don't even use that, you know, visa system. They just instead tap into a market for undocumented workers and hire undocumented workers that don't have those protections.
Before the whole coronavirus thing hit, there was a lot of discussion and a lot of people very concerned about all the illegal immigrants who were being held in detention centers near the border and the physical and health situation that they had. And that must be even worse now with the coronavirus.
An incredibly concentrated area. People are packed together. Yes, like you mentioned, Mary, both for migrants and for the people that work there, there is tremendous potential for this, for COVID-19 to spread throughout detention centers. And there's actually been, in some detention centers, some hunger strikes on the part of migrants in the centers saying, in order to send the message of, hey, we don't have any say over our own safety in these areas. We don't have any soap. There's no sort of social distancing measures coming into play. Sanitation methods and before and they haven't improved. And so I think this is something that we're not focusing on enough during this crisis of where are the places where people are packed together and don't have any say over their own social distancing and protection against COVID-19.
And for the immigrants that are working up here, a lot of them are afraid, even if they fear they might have COVID-19, to get medical help because they're afraid they might get rounded up.
Because not only are people fearful that if they go to get medical help, that they might be, targeted by ICE and detained and deported. But they're also fearful that the information that they give, you know, to seek get medical care might be used against them. And they have really valid fear that if they seek out medical care, it will be deemed as a public benefit.
And so this is something that has changed with the Trump administration?
Yeah, that falls under this new way that he has changed the public charge exclusion, such that if you receive public benefits, you're no longer eligible down the line to get legal residence here. So that has created such immense fear in the undocumented community and such confusion, because people are like, okay, if I get medical care, is that a public benefit? Am I going to be barred from becoming a citizen later down the line? And the Trump administration has clarified that seeking out, you know, treatment for COVID-19 doesn't count under the public charge exclusion. But even so, most people don't know that, or most people don't trust this administration to follow through with that.
That was Kelsey Freeman, author of the book, No Option But North, The Migrant World and the Perilous Path Across the Border. In 2016, only 23 years old, Freeman went to Central Mexico on a Fulbright scholarship to study immigration and teach English in that area. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, today is Earth Day, a day to demonstrate support for protecting our planet. Today, we'll explore what you can do to locally promote awareness. Plus, a local expert will talk about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the environment. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talks with Carrie Radloff, the chair of the Northwest Iowa Group Sierra Club.
So it is the half century point for Earth Day, April 22nd. And unfortunately, it's a day this time around that we won't be able to officially celebrate it outdoors. Well, we can go outdoors, but not with large groups of people.
It's unfortunate that this has happened, because there were a lot of huge gatherings and huge events planned. And of course, all these organizers had to shift gears and figure out how they could do everything from home.
Do you think people really pay attention to Earth Day? I know you may because of your role with the Sierra Club, but What do you think about the average person?
That the average person is aware of Earth Day and pays attention to Earth Day. It's a good reminder to people that we need to be grateful for and take care of the world around us. Literally everything we do has an impact on the planet and all living beings in it. We need healthy air, water, and soils to survive. However, because of that, we really can't let ourselves care about it only on Earth Day or during Earth Week or Earth Month. It's something that we need to be thoughtful with in our actions and our choices. You know, those in power politically or monetarily, like corporations and industry, should be reminded that they need to be proactive about taking care of our environment. Some people think that being green costs money, but it always costs more to fix a problem than to prevent it. So I think people are aware of Earth Day, but we can't only care about it on Earth Day.
And what can people do year-round to help the environment, at least here in Northwest Iowa and Siouxland?
We have, you know, a good core group of people who are working on issues. And, you know, if anybody is interested in volunteering or learning more about just about any topic related to the environment, we can connect them. Some of the issues that our Sierra Club members and friends are working on are like rewilding and creating safe habitat for wildlife. Letts Hills and prairie preservation is big for some of us, for me especially, here in the area. Also promoting native plants to support pollinators and water quality and capture carbon, and fighting the invasive species that is very prevalent and really likes to take over and crowd out our prairies. Also water quality in the Missouri River. We have some folks who really like to cultivate a love of nature in our youth and want to encourage people to visit what little nature we have left. Some of our members are very into food systems, creating safe food systems for people, the animals involved, and our soils and water. Some of us are big into renewable energy and energy conservation. And of course, reducing waste and encouraging recycling is big here in Sioux City too.
Where would you suggest someone go if they wanted to reconnect with the true nature that is found in our region? Where do you have some locations that you could suggest?
The first place that comes to mind is Broken Kettle Grasslands. It is, I believe, either the largest tract of remnant prairie, meaning that it's not been tilled and cropped. at least not all of it. And that is really what Northwest Iowa looked like. You know, the rolling hills and the prairies, and they have bison there that are to manage the prairie, and they are genetically pure bison, meaning they don't have any cattle DNA in them. But I think that's the best place to see what Northwest Iowa looked like and could look like again.
And that's Carrie Radloff. She is with the Northwest Iowa Group Sierra Club. She was talking to Siouxland Public Media, Sheila Brummer. For more information on the initiative by the Northwest Iowa Group Sierra Club, you can find a link on our website, KWIT, if you look for Carrie Radloff's interview. David Hofer is an associate professor of biology at Briarcliff University, and he is the chair of the biology department, and he also shares his insight today on Earth Day and COVID-19.
It should be a big celebration. This is the 50th Earth Day. I had the privilege of attending the University of Wisconsin for my graduate degree, for my PhD, and of course, one of the senators there, Senator Gaylord Nelson, helped to found Earth Day back in 1970. I graduated from the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW, so it's kind of near and dear to my heart. It's a day where hopefully everyone can remember that life itself is precious and that we need to treat it with respect.
And obviously right now, life is just kind of upside down, isn't it?
You know, the weird thing is what we're seeing is there's a lot more wildlife out there. Some of our major migratory corridors for birds, they're actually doing better. Birds are showing up in places where they traditionally don't show up during migration and in greater numbers. Seems to be due to our lack of being out there and disturbing the environment and therefore disturbing them.
Where are some of the spots that people are seeing those migrating birds?
Well, one of them, quite interestingly, it's not necessarily directly here in Northwest Iowa. I'm having trouble finding local data on that. But there is a major migratory corridor right around Israel, Lebanon, that area, where birds avoid having to traverse the Mediterranean as they make their way either up into Asia or into Europe. And they're showing up in a lot of orchards that are now being very poorly attended because people are staying home and social distancing. And there are also frogs that are showing up where you don't expect to see them, tree frogs, for instance. Here in the United States, I know there are reports that in our national parks, there's a lot more wildlife and they are roaming more widely. There's increased activity of black bears, for instance, out in Yosemite, which of course has a terrible problem with so many people being there that there's all kinds of air pollution, there's all kinds of noise pollution, and yet now we have a lot of the large mammals just roaming around, you know, looking for food early in the spring, and apparently being, you know, very well adapted to the conditions. This is about the time of year that black bears emerge from their hibernating dens.
Or actually, unfortunately, it seems like mankind, we're actually the hardest on the environment.
Oh, exactly. The air pollution that, I mean, Los Angeles has now reported some of the best air in the last week of all major cities in the entire world. And of course, that's never been true. You know, Los Angeles is situated in this valley and is known for terrible air. If you've seen the pictures of New Delhi in India, where it's just this terrible brown fog that seems to envelop the city, and now perfectly clear skies, and you can see all around you. I mean, our lack of activity should show us, hey, wait a minute, the environment's far better when we don't behave the way we normally behave. This should be our wake-up call. We don't have to live this way, because all of that pollution, all of that noise, it's not just disturbing to the wildlife, and it doesn't just kill wildlife. It is disturbing to us, causes stress in us, causes a variety of disorders, and ultimately kills hundreds of thousands of people, well, actually millions of people around the world every single year, if you just look at air pollution.
Have you noticed any trends when it comes to COVID-19 for Northwest Iowa, for Siouxland, even without that official information or data?
I have not seen local data where I can actually, you know, see the trends well. The past few days, I've been seeing a red-breasted nuthatch at my bird feeders in my backyard. And red-breasted nuthatches like pine trees, so they're not here in great abundance. And so it makes me wonder, you know, are there more of them here? Are they exploring the territory more because of the relatively, you know, relatively lower noise and pollution standards because we're sheltering at home? But getting local data is something that has been extremely hard.
And where would you get that information usually?
Well, mostly I've been going to scientific publications. A lot of the air quality, for instance, would come from Columbia University that has fantastic geosciences monitoring and climate monitoring. Otherwise, I scour news reports for science information and then see if they link to articles. So that's what I've been trying to do, but I have not really been able to find really good local information here in Northwest Iowa. Now, the trends that we're seeing, there's no necessarily really good reason to say that there wouldn't be similar things happening here in Northwest Iowa, but of course, without specific data, you can't really say for sure.
No, that makes sense. And of course, you are a professor and you've had to modify what you do as far as your teaching too because of this whole pandemic.
Exactly. Everything's now online. trying to teach online and trying to reach students online is it's a whole different ballgame, really.
It's kind of difficult when you're out of your routine, right? It seems like it takes longer to get the work that you want done finished.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that I feel like I have more work now than I did when I was teaching face-to-face courses. And of course, I miss the interaction with the students, and I miss their direct questions and filling them in. And like when I lecture, then I give these little stories that you know, try to tie things together and look at things from an environmental perspective. And now online, it's kind of like, you know, here's the straight basic information, and we've got to get through this. And I'm kind of missing those connections.
And that was David Hofer. He is an associate professor of biology at Briarcliff University, also the chair of the biology department there. Well, Earth Day is still a big deal at the Dorothy Pico Nature Center in Sioux City. While the center is not open for the event, there's a lot going on, according to Dawn Snyder, the center's education program director.
The trails are still open, and we've been working hard to try to do some different virtual education and reaching out to our audiences. Join us at 1:30 on Earth Day for a Facebook Live. We're going to be on top of the ridge at the Dorothy Pico Nature Center on the Luss Ridge doing a live hike, seeing what we can find in the prairie up on the ridge and whether there's blooming wildflowers or birds.
It's kind of sad. I mean, so many plans had been made for the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And, you know, I remember when I was a little kid and this became an event. And boy, things have certainly changed in 50 years.
They certainly have. And I'm dating myself because in 1970, the very first Earth Day, I was in kindergarten. And I remember planting a tree on the school grounds. And then fast forward 20 years later, in 1990, the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, I was here at the in Sioux City working for the Woodbury County Conservation Board before the Nature Center was built, and it was one of my first years on the job, and there was a big community effort to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Earth Day in 1990 here in Sioux City. And we had a celebration at Riverside Park. There were community members from all sorts of different organizations, such as the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society and the City of Sioux City and the advisory board. At that time, there was Sioux Land Recycles. There was all sorts of different folks that came together for the celebration at Riverside Park. And we had speakers and booths and planted trees and did all sorts of things. So that was kind of my first, I guess, remembrance of doing Earth Day activities here in Sioux City. And now as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, we kind of like to, I guess my reflection and my take on Earth Day is that, of course, I want people to think about Earth Day every day and to continue to strive to do different things to help the environment, to help their local community. We have a few other things that we are doing here at the Nature Center for Earth Day. In addition to our Facebook Live event at 1:30 today, you can also come out on your own, not necessarily today on Earth Day, but later or another time throughout the next week or so. We have a self-guided scavenger hunt on the trail that you can hike the trails on your own, of course, using good social distancing, and look for the different Earth logos that are on the trail, and there's a little fact about Earth Day and some different ways you can do your part while you're hiking the trail. So you can learn a little bit about Earth and Earth Day while you're taking your stroll here on our trails at the Dorothy Pico Nature Center. Obviously, if you're on Facebook and also Instagram, we've been posting the last week about how you can be involved for Earth Day and also some different fun crafts that you can upcycle or recycle different things to make some crafts. And so look for those posts.
That was Dawn Snyder, Education Director at the Dorothy Pico Nature Center in Sioux City, talking about Earth Day. Today is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, so you might want to go out there and celebrate it. Social distance yourself, but it's a beautiful day outside, so it's a good day for that. Well, that is it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and also to Steve Smith for their help with the show.